Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Diversity is one of MTSU's watchwords and one of its enduring goals. Dr. Martha Norkunis of the History Department has made a contribution to both diversity awareness and history education with her fall 2010 class titled Research in American History, Landscape, Ethnography, the Image, and the Artifact. This is a class for graduate students, which charges each of them with taking one group on the MTSU campus and examining its culture in several ways. Here with us to talk about what they found are Dr. Norkunis and some of her students, by name Erin Huxtable from Knoxville, Hallie Feaser from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, Sherry LaFlame from Erie, Pennsylvania, Sarah Rieger from Union City, and Jesse Klein-Dinst from Chesapeake, Virginia, Mandy Pitt from Nashville, Garrett Bledden from Greenville, South Carolina, and Martha. And we're going to start with you, Dr. Norkunis. Where did the idea for this class come from?
Well, the history department had suggested, since I'm a specialist in oral history, that I work with some of the graduate students on using non-standard, I'm not calling them non-traditional sources, but non-standard sources, to expose them to ideas other than text documents. But I teach two graduate seminars already in oral narrative, so I thought, well, I'll use some other fascinating sources that history students might not typically use in their work. So I decided to use ethnography, the close observation of living cultures, cultural geography, how people use space to express their cultural ideas, the image. And we read some incredible articles about how to interpret photography in terms of history and culture, and the artifact, which is basically the object or thing, and what that can mean and what that can reveal about history and culture of a group of people.
And how does this differ from standard way of looking at history? We're talking about primary sources, secondary sources. Of course, if you're interviewing an eyewitness to an event, that person would be a primary source. How does this differ from more conventional ways of looking at history?
Many historians rely primarily on text documents, either primary sources or secondary sources analyses by other historians. This is an opportunity, as historians become increasingly interdisciplinary, for students to think about the resources available to them when they work with living communities in the present, and how to access ideas about the past, not through text documents, but through these other kinds of sources that we don't often think of as rich in historical information.
Did you set specific parameters for them to use in picking the MTSU cultural group they'd focus on, or did they have sort of wide latitude?
Oh, it was a pretty wide latitude. But I wanted particularly for some of my students to work with groups that are perhaps not as well understood on the campus. And two of my students worked with people from the Muslim community. So that would increase, I'd hope, some understanding of that culture group. But then they really picked culture groups based on their own interests.
Well, we're going to start over here with Garrett and ask you how you went about choosing the group you chose to examine.
I actually did not work with the group on campus. I live up in Nashville, and I chose to work with Nashville's downtown homeless. Primary reason I worked with that group is, for me, is I like examining history as a dialogue of power. Who has been documented? Who do we have records of? Who do we not have records of? That led me to think about groups that we might not think of in the historical record, but yet they do have an impact on the landscape, and they do leave a historical footnote.
So that, you were thinking in terms of socioeconomic class as opposed to race, religion, and other demographic identifying factors.
Definitely, but also so many of these other groups with race, religion, a lot of these groups, there has already been a huge in-depth study of in this area. There really has not been an in-depth study in the Nashville-specific area working with the downtown homeless. So this was a new opportunity.
Was it hard to identify the homeless, which it's even hard to get a figure nationally on how many people are homeless because it's continually in flux?
It very much is, and you're really working with a mobile populace. So unlike a lot of cultural groups where you have one person who can open the door for you to meet other people and get more information, each time you make contact, you're starting from square one. So you don't have that deeper rapport. And the trick with Nashville's downtown homeless is a lot of them do act with integrity, and it may be difficult to initially spot someone and just know, are they homeless or not?
Where did you go? Did you go to the unemployment office? Did you go to the union mission, soup kitchens? Did you go find guys who are on the corner and with squeegees or holding up signs saying, you know, please donate or whatever?
Actually, none of the above. I picked two options. The first one is in the downtown. You're seeing it more in Middle Tennessee now. There's a newspaper called The Contributor, which is sold for a dollar. And these are sold by individuals that are homeless as a way of building kind of their own personal business to try and get off the streets. So that was step one. And also, and there's a courtyard across from Nashville's Public Library downtown where a lot of the homeless will gather waiting for the library to open because it gives them access to restrooms, water fountains, some of these basic necessities.
Did you feel better about going about it that way than trying to approach them through some social service agency and having that be the conduit? Did you feel like you got a more direct, more comprehensive view? Or
definitely. And I think the other thing is some of the cultural liaisons I met, I believe me coming to them directly, they appreciated more because it's a person showing them the respect of paying them attention. One of the statements issued by a lot of them is, no one will even look at us. They pretend we're not here. So me taking about 3 hours on an afternoon and just talking with an individual, asking questions, really impacted them.
What did you learn?
Really, how little separates any of us from the homeless. Physically, you really cannot tell a difference. It really comes, think about how many people are one emergency or one crisis away. Many of us, even the middle class, if there's an extended illness, if there's a natural disaster, if there's a fire, any of these things, we very quickly could be out of our home. And if we do not have a support network in place to back us up, we could be joining them.
What kind of artifacts did you have?
Places, actually. This one particular individual, it was a park bench because he does have a mood disorder, that is depression. And for him, the park bench downtown was a very important place because when he would start to have his depressive episodes from just losing everything a bit on the streets, watching the tourist along Broadway, seeing everything helped him to cope in a way. It kind of pulled him out of his own thoughts and out of his own perspective and helped him to dream and just think about one day this could be me.
Mandy, what about you?
Like Garrett, I also worked with a community that's not on the MTSU campus. I'm from West Nashville, which is kind of undergoing this cultural change right now. And so I chose to work with my neighbors as my initial cultural liaisons, who are a Vietnamese family. They moved into my neighborhood about a year ago. And so I really just met with them for an interview. And then from there, I kind of wanted to move into more of an understanding of the commercial landscape and how this ethnic change has really altered the landscape in West Nashville, specifically the Charlotte Park, Charlotte Avenue area.
What was the demographic makeup of that area before the Vietnamese population moved in?
It's a traditionally working class, mostly white neighborhood, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you find out about the Vietnamese population in that neighborhood?
Well, the people I worked with specifically were, they were Catholic, which is something we shared in common, which was something I was interested in. I also kind of ended up coming to the conclusion that there's this larger community, more than what I was aware of, because I met with my neighbors. And then when I wanted to move into the more commercial landscape, I decided to go to a business that I knew was owned by a Vietnamese family, and they actually ended up knowing my neighbors, and they were friends, they went to the same church. So that would be something that would be interesting for further research, is to kind of delve into this community a little more. So,
what sorts of artifacts did they have?
The object that I chose to analyze was actually the street sign for the bank of businesses that my business that I worked with was in, because I really thought this was a really great way to continue to analyze this commercial landscape, and not only just the Vietnamese culture, but also the other ethnicities that are making up like this new demographic in West Nashville.
How else has the neighborhood changed? Do you see signs in a multiplicity of languages, whereas they were formerly only in English?
Yeah, a rise in an ethnic population contributes to the alteration of an urban district by making changes to the cultural landscape, specifically in commercial streetscapes, so not in the housescapes of the area. So, you know, just driving down, say, any of the streets in Charlotte Park, you wouldn't be able to tell. And, you know, looking at my house and the house next door, you wouldn't be able to tell. But driving down Charlotte Avenue in this business district, that's when you're able to see these multiplicities of cultures. So Vietnamese, Korean, Hispanic, and even recently Mediterranean and Middle Eastern. So
now let's talk a little bit with Jesse. And what group did you select?
I initially wanted to work with a Jewish family in Nashville. I'm Christian, and there are a lot of relations, of course, with my Bible, and the Jewish traditions as well. And I just didn't know enough about it. Well, in searching for one, I met a Jewish family. I met a man named Wayne Clemens, and when I was introduced to him as being a Jewish man. And he's like, "Oh no, I'm not Jewish. I'm Messianic." And I said, "Oh, what is that?" And he said, "Well, actually, I believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but I have Jewish practices and foundational beliefs." I was like, "Okay, so where is this going to take us?" So we began talking and communicating because they attend Shabbat, they eat kosher, they also celebrate the Jewish high holidays like Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, but they all have that turn to where they are actually Christians, and the fact they believe that Jesus is the Messiah and he has come.
And where do they live specifically, or are they all throughout the Nashville
all
area?
All throughout the Nashville area. I've been as far north as Clarksville, met some people here in Murfreesboro. The home church that I visited was in Waterton, Tennessee, which is beyond Wilson County. East towards Knoxville. We've also have families at that church that were even from Tullahoma.
Faith. Were they born into Messianic families, or were they born into, Reform or other Jewish families and then converted as they got older?
Both. Actually, some of the families that were at this church, which is Lamb Fellowship in Waterton, Tennessee, some of the families were Jewish, born Jewish and converted. Some were born into some Reformed families. Wayne Clemens and his family, the particular family I talked to, he was actually born into a Methodist family. When he was about 13 or 14, his parents converted to Messianicism. And he was raised in the faith and then married a woman who had just converted herself.
Have they encountered any difficulty becoming accepted by other more traditional Jews?
Definitely. In fact, as I understood it from Wayne, this is one of the reasons that Lamb Fellowship was kind of established. A couple of Messianic groups here in Nashville were not as accepting of families that had converted to Messianicism from a Protestant background or Catholic background. So there is a little bit of a strife, a division between people who are Jewish and converted to Messianicism versus people who are Protestant Catholic and converted to Messianicism. There seems to be a bit of a rift there.
And now let's go on to Sarah.
Yes, I worked with Muslim women on campus here at MTSU. I actually met my contact through Dr. Narcunas, who emailed another professor who was Muslim, and he got in touch with some of his students, and my contact emailed me back, and we started a correspondence from that.
Had you known Muslim students on campus prior to taking this class?
I had not.
Had you had classes with any of them? Just happened to have classes?
No, I had not. No.
Why did you pick this particular group?
Well, at the beginning of the semester, it was during the controversy of the mosque going up, and there was just a little bit more violence and just general stereotyping of Muslims, which I knew wasn't true, but it was hard to convince others that some of those horrible stereotypes weren't true, so I thought this would be a good chance to show what Muslims are really like.
Just to clarify, you're talking about the proposed construction of the Islamic Center.
Yes.
A new Islamic Center. They have one right now, but it's behind a car lubrication business, and they are hoping to expand into a larger plot, and they have been met with opposition, some of it civil and some of it not so civil.
Right.
And how have the Muslim students that you've spoken to reacted to all of this?
I haven't gone into depth with them about this, but my contact that I'm using for this assignment, she has picked up on it. There have been times where she won't admit it, but it's obvious that she's a little shaky in public, the one time we did walk around on campus. And she's really sensitive to it, but at the same time, she believes that her faith will keep her protected, so she just tries not to worry about it.
Has she encountered any grief from anyone here on campus about being Muslim?
She has not.
Do they encounter more grief in the external community than they do in the campus community?
That I don't believe so.
So they seem to be doing rather well.
Yes.
Okay. What did you learn about the way in which they maintain their culture and yet integrate into the larger culture?
That is actually something me and my contact have talked kind of in depth about. She is, she firmly believes in her religion and not compromising her religion for the culture. So she is very traditional. She wears the headscarf and she wears the full abaya dress every day. She has for about a year now.
And now let's go to Sherry.
I chose to work with the marching band, so I picked something that wasn't an externally visible culture group like the Muslim women would have been or some of the other examples. And that's because, for me, music has always been a big part of my identity, and I've been called a band geek more times than I can count. Uh-huh. So when we're talking about tolerance and respect and having that for other culture groups, I wanted to pick something that wasn't as obvious. Something that you choose to associate with.
Are members of the marching band stereotyped?
I think so. I think music in general, whether it's Glee Club like the TV show or marching band, or I grew up in Pennsylvania and liked country music and got picked on for that. It's not as cool there as it is in Nashville.
So if you're a member of the marching band, you are allegedly what? A weirdo? A what?
I think geek is the word.
You're so into your trip that nobody else is as much into your trip as you are, or at least you think so.
Yeah, I think that would be right, yeah.
Okay. Do members of the marching band have any, shall I say, cultural traditions of their own, things that are uniquely theirs in terms of ritual or tradition? Or do they represent a kind of brotherhood? Is there a unity there that is akin to that of some other kind of a cultural group bound by race or religion or ethnicity?
I think so. I think that's exactly what you have. They're held together by a common interest, though. And while you have a sense of unity, there's also distinct groups that form within the band. And so what I observed was that, you know, all the clarinets would hang out together, and all of the tubas would hang out together, and the majorettes would hang out together, and it seems that they separate themselves and define themselves within the band by their own individual section.
And then how do all of these different pieces come together and play as one if they are attuned to their own individual groups?
I think that they're attuned to both. I think it's not just about their own distinctive part, their own role, but I think they all understand they're a part of this bigger performance and that they're all performing for the same purpose. And so I think that that's what creates the unity within the group.
So are there parallels to be learned here between the way the band has its own individual groups and integrates into the larger band and the way an ethnic minority has cultural aspects that are uniquely its own and then integrates into the more dominant society?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what I was seeing. And I think it's important for people who are outside of the group to understand that they can't know everything, that they can't, they may not be perceiving those smaller pieces, and not to make assumptions.
Hallie, how about you?
I chose to work with Somali women on the campus of MTSU. And much like Sarah, I was intrigued because of the controversy with the new Islamic Center. But at first, I was concerned about which group I would pick because Dr. Norkunis stressed that we should pick a group that was different from any cultural aspect of our own. And so the prospect of that horrified me, honestly. And everyone can attest to that. But once I decided to work with them, she introduced me to Kadro, who was a student that she had met on campus, who actually she just walked up to her outside of the KUC and talked to her. And so then I started communicating with her, and we met in the library. And throughout the course of the semester, we've shared a lot. And I've not only learned about myself, I learned about them, but I also learned about myself by learning their values and their what they hold important. I was able to see for myself that I have a lot of things in common that I thought I would never have.
What brought them here?
In 1991, in Somalia, the government, the federal government, basically fell there, and there has been civil war since. They left about 10 years ago and came to Nashville.
Why the Middle Tennessee area in particular? Was there any a special reason, or was it just, were there Somalis already here that they knew, or did they think this was where the jobs were, or?
There are some Somalis here, but we didn't necessarily talk about that much. Okay. They just informed me when they came here, and then they started a new life here 10 years ago.
What did you find out about their culture?
One of the most interesting things was the unit on photography and applying photography. The images that they both shared with me. I met Kadro, and then she introduced me to her friend Yasmin. And Kadro and Yasmin both shared images. When I asked them to share their most meaningful image or photograph so far, they both showed me images from their high school graduation in Nashville. And they're both posed next to their mothers. They are both dressed in the typical black or gray American Muslim traditional attire, the hijab and everything. And then their mothers are dressed in very colorful, bright, the traditional African Muslim headscarf and clothing. And they both emphasize the importance of education, that in Somalia, they wouldn't have necessarily achieved high school graduation, but they not only achieved it, they excelled and were both towards the top of their class at graduation. And they both emphasized that they would love to share that with their daughters one day and encourage them just like their mothers had.
Is it more difficult for women to get an education in Somalia?
Yes. They both made that very clear.
How do they feel in the current culture? Do they feel, I mean, you mentioned that when you asked them for photography, it was photography of their high school graduation. Here it wasn't photography of their country of origin, which is interesting. So they feel comfortable in the society now?
I would say so. And walking, when I did the cultural geography section, walking through campus with Kadro, everybody came up to her and acted like she was a celebrity almost. I mean, she was friendly with everybody and everybody enjoyed her. She made jokes to different people as we were walking, and she seemed like she fit in better than me walking around. So.
Aaron, is there anything that you'd like to say about your cultural group?
I had the pleasure of working with a fellow named Anthony, who's an African-American man, who's involved here on campus with an organization called the Collegiate 100 Black Men. He's one of the officers of this organization, and so the way he expressed to me the objectives of the organization was that they are essentially a community service organization. It's a fraternal organization to a certain extent because it's African-American men, but their primary objectives being the development of young African-American men, pushing them to reach their fullest potential through education, and basically guiding them through mentoring programs and other community outreach.
And what did you consider to be an artifact?
The artifact was actually one of the more interesting aspects, because the artifact that he chose to present was a portrait from his family. The portrait he chose was actually a portrait of his great-great-grandfather, who was from Nigeria. The portrait itself actually is a reproduction given to his father by one of his patients. His father's a doctor in Antioch, I think. Mm-hmm. It was a gift to his father from one of his patients who happened to be an artist, who I guess must have seen the original portrait, it's a smaller picture, in his office and wanted to express his gratitude. And so what he did is he made this larger rendition it's in colored pencil. And it was interesting to see that he was alone, because I was sort of thinking along the lines of, if this is a family man, where's his family? Is this because it was just his singular portrait and there are other portraits that would complete this set, or were there certain constraints upon his person, social or economic or even time-wise, that would prevent such an inclusion, and just different aspects related to the persistence or loss of an artifact?
It seems like it symbolizes the organization you chose, however, because it whether it was a family member or not, there's a sense of continuity and brotherhood amongst everyone who shares these common traits or common goals, regardless of whether they are your blood kin or not. And Martha, to just round it up and sum it up, I've asked each and every one of the students you have here assembled what they learned. Now I'm going to ask you, the teacher, what you learned.
One of the things that always impresses me is what a rewarding experience it is for two people who initially assume they have perhaps nothing in common.
And some of the students may actually named and mentioned the individuals in question here. Mm-hmm.
And then they get to know them in a setting that's artificially created. And then there develops a mutual respect, and sometimes a caring, and sometimes even a friendship that comes out of this. So I was really absolutely delighted with the work that my students did, really going outside of their normal cultural boundaries to think, who is this other person? How can I use these four areas of inquiry to begin to understand her or him and their culture and their worldview? And then to turn the lens back on themselves to say, and what now do I know about myself and my own society by having done this inquiry? So for me, it's very enriching to see the work that the students do. The one student that wasn't able to make it today worked with Laotian Buddhists, and she spent some time at the Buddhist temple in Murfreesboro. So the openness, I guess, of the people from diverse cultures in Murfreesboro to participating in a project like that, and the openness of my students to being able to really hear, with a capital H, what someone else is saying.
So among those of you listening, if you previously thought of history as something musty, dusty, and date-centric, we hope we have disabused you of that notion here today with Dr. Martha Norkunis and her students. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. We invite you to join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.